Have you ever heard of bunny chow or cook sisters? Bubuti, chicken tikka. These are all dishes that shaped my world as a child just because of migration. Come with me, Erica von Kaschke, as we pass the cinnamon stick to people who have come to Australia. Listen to their migration stories, to what they bring to the land down under and what they get from it.
So it's my privilege to interview Silas today. Silas is one of the mental health advocates here at Multicultural Futures and probably one of the most jovial people that I know. It's hard to imagine that he works in such a, you know, like a heavy industry. So Silas, where did you grow up?
I'm from India. I grew up in the southern state of Kerala. But I'm originally from the neighboring state, Tamil Nadu. So I was actually born about pretty much there, the southern tip of the country, in a town or two of the southern tip. And then we kind of moved on to a place called Cochin in Kerala state, which is on the west coast. I did all my schooling there. And then after that, I left, after schooling, I left and I've been all over the place.
So Silas, you know, India's a big place, but from where you're from, what do you think is the best thing about the culture in that region?
Well, a few things. One is the state, it's a very beautiful state. I mean, it's rich in resources. And, it, you know, for many years, it took a stand as one of the only state which had maximum literacy. The state of Kerala had the highest literacy, and now it's like 100% literacy. So that means everybody in the state is literate. And we do have, people are very, there's a lot of intellectualized kind of thinking over there. But unfortunately, it was a Marxist or a communist state, so it's got its drawbacks. But it's a beautiful place, and the place where I lived for many years, a city called Cochin, which now they call Kochi, is also another beautiful place full of backwaters.
I know that a lot of people associate India always with food and flavor, but which flavor do you associate with happiness in your growing up years?
One of the things growing up in India is like so many festivals. It's not just your faith festival alone, right? So when you look at it, it was so much of a, the cultural makeup there was so much different. Like, you know, we could have festivals, and every festival is kind of linked with also food. And so you could have a variety of this lot. And my mom's a great cook. And so, she didn't have to use us as her guinea pigs. I think she pretty much used my dad as a guinea pig initially. So when we came and food was great, and mom's cooking is really fantastic. Even now she's in her mid-80s, even now she likes seafood.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's just great. So
what's your favorite seafood?
Favorite seafood is fish curry.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it's fish curry. And if you from where I come from, there is this fish curry and tapioca.
Oh.
So tapioca is actually a tuber.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. So they boil tapioca and you have this fish curry. Yeah, it's fantastic. So it's interesting because when I first moved to, I lived in New Zealand for many years, so then moved to Australia. And when I first moved to New Zealand, everybody's talking about food as butter chicken.
Okay.
I've never heard of butter chicken back. You know, I lived in India till my late 30s. Never, you know, butter chicken was one among must be thousands of dishes, so I have no thing. But when I first moved to New Zealand, I was immediately kind of, you know, as soon as you say you're from India, the first thing they say, all you talk about, you know, food and, you know, all the kind of stuff, the thing they ask is, do you love butter chicken? And I just rolled my eyes and understand, what are you talking about? Because, famous for seafood. For me, my anything anything that smells like seafood is great.
It's great. I know a lot of migrants who have done the two country hop or one country hop before coming to Australia. How did you find that, moving to New Zealand first? Do you think it really prepared you for life in Australia, or what was your experience?
Yes and no, because first when I moved over to New Zealand, I mean, you know, our qualifications were, it was, they first thought, I mean, they said that I was highly qualified, as overqualified in a few other things. So that was a big shock for us when we moved. And so we had to kind of go back and do, retrain and do a whole lot of stuff. But then I had trained enough, I'd done this, and moving to Australia was with a job. And I knew exactly what I wanted. I could dictate my terms. It was different here.
So what was your first memory of arriving in Australia?
I came here in 2011. I think it was around August or September. And I was told by my friends in New Zealand not to move to Australia because they said it's nothing but snakes and kangaroos. Well, I didn't find anything when I landed over here. So it was a little disappointing. I thought the drive from the airport would be one of those bushy or
crocodile Dundee
kind of a thing. It was not like that. No, actually, on a serious note, I think it was good. You know, like I said, I was quite prepared for our move over here. It was not like it's an unknown thing. It was kind of, new. So I'd been to Australia a few times before.
So when did you start working at Multicultural Futures?
It's going to be 4.5 years, so it's about, I think, 2016.
So what do you like about working at Multicultural Futures?
One thing is, it's a great place because pretty much everyone comes from different cultures. It's like a masala, a mix of cultures. I've got to learn a lot more about different cultures after joining this place. Or the previous jobs, it was, just mostly mainstream. So there's very not many cultures around, whereas over here people do talk a lot about their culture, and obviously they talk a lot about where they come from and everything. So that's something that I really like over here. There's so many things that are happening. As a team, I think the thing is, there's something unique about our service. I'm not trying to market our service, but what I'm trying to say is because we don't say no to any client or any referral that comes through, or any service that sends a client across, we don't say no to that, simply because we have the resources to go and meet up. And that I find really, really refreshing compared to so many other agencies where they have a long wait list or clients that turn back because they can't see themselves. I enjoy working in an atmosphere, in a setup which has got all this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's great. And, from the outside, the mental health team, it's like everybody really cares about the clients. That's one thing that I think that people can, the team can joke around. There's this camaraderie within the team. But the one thing that I think really binds them together is that they all really care about their clients.
Yeah. It's interesting because our clients come back to us, in a good way. I don't say that they're dependent on us or anything or that we think, but it's just the fact that they know that they have a place that they can always turn to if they have any issues. And most of our clients are still struggling. Even if they've been here for many years, they still struggle with the system. So many barriers, social barriers. And they're still there, and they come back to us to just get our help. We support them through that process. And also being advocates for them, sometimes it really helps our clients. That's one of the best rewarding parts, is when you know that the client is not going to slip through the cracks in the system, that you're there to kind of support them, get them through the other side.
And so you're at the Langford office.
Yeah.
Within that community, after 4 years, can you talk a little bit about how things have grown for you as a mental health advocate, your relationship with the community in the area?
We are one among many, many agencies there, in that area. For a client, it doesn't really matter which agency they go to. So I think the most important thing is you got to get the other agencies to kind of work alongside you, or you got to work alongside them first. Mm-hmm. So that by itself is a task, because it does... based on the size of the agency and where you are, makes a lot of this. So my first thing was always to make sure that the agencies knew, and then it's the agencies who are going to refer clients. It's the agencies who are going to talk about our service to clients. Some agencies don't specialize in the areas that we work in. So it's important. And it's a slow process. And I'm reasonably pleased with that progress because most agencies know us, and that's where we get our referrals to.
What has been the most rewarding thing for you so far? What's been the highlight for you over the last 4 years?
I can't really pinpoint exactly one single thing that highlighted, but I think the most important thing is, like I said, the team is more like a family. We have fun together. At the same time, we are also able to share our, you know, pain, especially when we're dealing with clients and stuff like that, you know, and it's a very open, transparent system, which I like. Well, I think we're trying very seriously to push and promote mental health, especially domestic violence. That's really hard trying to explain it to men and, you know, getting men involved in that. But when you have, you know, there have been instances where men have been part of that, who kind of benefited from our service and helped them. Yeah, so I think that's one of the areas. So what I'm trying to say is, like, certain things, we can't really service everybody and make everyone happy, but if you're able to do it with a small section of the crowd also, it makes a lot of difference.
Why did you choose to work in the mental health field?
That's interesting because my background is marine biology back in India. I was a shrimp and, you know, I did my studies, everything in fisheries and all that. I worked in the industry and everything, but having moved to New Zealand, they said no. I didn't find any job or anything around that area. And so I went back to uni and did some studies and started with counseling there. So I did my counseling studies there. I chose to work in the mental health, and I was working for many years in the drug and alcohol field. And then after that, and in some of my jobs, it is both mental health and drug and alcohol. So right now I do both mental health and drug and alcohol, yeah. But more of mental health in this job.
COVID has had a huge effect on the mental health of people, I think, in general in our society. What have you seen happen for your clients? How did they cope with it?
Most of them struggle because of what is happening in their home country. It's not so much over here, because here they had this kind of, they felt a lot more safe and secure around the way things were. Whereas they were not sure of what was happening in their home country. So a lot of our clients are from Afghanistan or from Pakistan or from, you know, Iran, Iraq, and, you know, all those places. And things were not going very well there. And a lot of South Americans also. For them, the major concern was that. I think most of the one that really affected a lot of clients is isolations. Kind of a self-isolation. There's a lot of trauma that our clients have gone through in the past, so this was nothing for them. This is another trauma part, you know, on a lighter scale for them. So I don't think that was much of an impact, but it's just the social isolation, like a level of insecurity that crops up for everybody, and for them especially. For some, it was actually pretty advantageous, because the ones who had finished up with their visas, who were looking at being deported, they said, no, they're not going to deport anybody. Immigration is not going to be functioning as such. They were relieved, actually, that there's something like this, a disaster was happening, a pandemic which is shutting down. So that means they didn't have to, you know, expect
their whole family.
Kind of go back. So, yeah, everyone had a different way of looking at it. Most of them, it was self-isolation, the isolation part, and losing their jobs or something, because they were working part-time, and even that, they lost their hours, so it was hard.
And has it triggered past trauma for some people? No.
Well, like I said, I mean, I think the trauma there was the feeling of, once again, a feeling of insecurity, that's all. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, because a lot of them do have come from war-torn countries, so this was nothing, you know, death was nothing for them. Just a question of, okay, we come here, we're looking at a future, but there's no future kind of a thing. So that sense of bleakness was, you know, everybody was talking about isolation and they couldn't stock up on their toilet paper.
Yes. So Silas, you also work with international students living in Perth, and I think it's a group that we don't hear a lot about. So how has the COVID situation affected them?
It's really sad because that's one sector that the government has kind of, you know, I think it's important that mental health should be really taken very seriously in this sector because it's a billion-dollar business, but what in return these people get is nothing. I mean, to say, yes, they get their education, they get it, but like their mental health is not taken care of. Most of them come here with pre-existing trauma, pre-existing mental health and all that. They come over here. A lot of them come here because their agents have sold them a different story, told them they can come here, they do a 1 year of English, and Australia is going to welcome them with open arms, and you know, the next thing you know is they're going to get a job, and they're going to be here forever. Reality hits them hard. That's not the case. So they get, you know, a lot of them just don't want to go back because, you know, it's different, you know, just they want to stay back. So they end up actually spending more money. The mental health state is pretty bad. I've encountered a lot of them talking about wanting to end their life. You know, suicide is so high a thought, you know, whether they carry it out or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they still are quite suicidal in the way they... And COVID, it got really bad because the hospitality industry was hit hard. And most of them work in the hospitality industry. So they lost their jobs. And these are people, not everyone comes here with a lot of money. And so they couldn't call back and ask their family to support them. So they were, you know, a lot of them are literally starving. We don't have no Centrelink help or anything of that sort. They were, I know for never thing. But the sad part was also some of them got into the wrong crowd to kind of make that extra money. So it is sad. They're forced to do certain things. But most of them, it was hard for them actually. Yeah, they lost their jobs. They didn't have enough money. It was quite disappointing for them. Yeah.
What are the options that they have at the moment?
Okay. Well, it's getting better now. And jobs have gone back to job. But yeah, they didn't have many options actually when you think about it, because most of the schools that they don't have a proper mental health worker in the school, they don't have the insurance they have does not cover for mental health in most cases. So I think the government should insist on this, them getting better insurance covers.
Mm-hmm.
If they're coming over here, or at least talk to the insurance companies to cover mental health and collect such huge fees, and most of them are kind of linked up with universities. And I think plus also the fact that once they come here and they struggle with their English and they know that they can't learn the language just like that in 6 months, they just lose the plot.
You know, it takes time to get used to being in a new country. There
yes.
is that whole mourning that you must go through, of
yeah.
mourning your culture, being away from your family. So on top of that, to have all these stresses, it must be incredibly hard for these young people.
Yeah.
And sometimes I was amazed. I worked at UWA for a bit, seeing actually older couples come, their spouse and a child, and then that must be on top of it, must be quite a lot more stress.
Yeah. It is, because it's like a domino's effect, right? It's not just one person is affected by what's happening around. That one person takes it on to the other person, and then
mm-hmm.
it goes on. So it happens. I mean, it's like the kids are too young. They don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's most of them, it just goes off because they're in they join some school or do some activities, and they keep themselves busy. But it's also, in most cases, when you go into those mature students, it's again a question of back in their home country, they would have been earning, they would have had a good life
mm-hmm.
style or whatever it is. They come here, you know, just
yeah.
to better themselves. And then things change, you know, financially, they are, you know, they're not able to manage. There's so many things that happen, and, you know. And another big thing that we noticed during the COVID time was there was a spike in domestic violence.
So are there community groups that support these students? Like, I know there's a big community that actually comes from Kerala. So let's say they're Indian students. Could they be get involved with an organization? Or are there people out there that are willing to help?
There are. I mean, I know there are some South American communities that are their clubs that they go in and kind of join in. But to what extent they're supportive kids, I don't know. I mean, the students, I don't know, because there's always a perception that the students who come here to study are moneyed. They got a lot of money and they're just coming here to study, kind of a thing. They can manage, unless the student chooses to go and get involved with these agencies or these clubs or community activities. It's difficult. I don't know to what extent that they are helpful.
Silas, you're probably one of the most joyful people that I know. Always ready to crack a few jokes. So how do you look after yourself to make sure that you can best help your clients?
Look after myself, you know.
And yes.
I'm not a joke. And I think in the kind of field that you're in, you know, the people, when all you're listening to is misery and pain and hurt and everything going around, humor is good if you know how to do it. So long as you're not hurting anybody, you just have fun. That's all it is. With most of my clients know that I mean well, and if I can joke with them, I joke, and I'm happy. They're also happy because most of them have a lot of issues in their life, and all they want is some little bit of if somebody can put a smile on their face, why not?
That's great.
Yeah.
And so, what else do you do to kind of help yourself?
Help myself. I set these boundaries, work is work, and when I go home, I'm home. And I've got a lovely family, so that's what it is. Possibly watch something online, keep myself busy, Netflix or something like that, or movies. I'm a big fan of movies, so listen to good music. I write a little bit of poetry, so just kind of do everything around here, so.
Well, that's really nice.
Myself,
I didn't know you did a bit of writing.
I do, yeah, sometimes.
That's excellent. I always ask the same two questions at the end of the show. Which word or phrase in your language did you bring with you and that you kind of hold on to as like a life philosophy?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about that. Okay, I think Esue is Jesus.
Yeah.
Or Esue is God.
Yeah.
And for me, that's very important because, I mean, it's a lot more than just Esue, it is important because I'm not a deeply religious person or anything, but I kind of link a lot of my life with faith.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I kind of carry that deal in my thing. And come what may, I just say just that, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
It is something that anchors. It is that anchor point that you can.
Yeah,
it does.
I mean, I think it's important that we find it's an anchor. Yeah, it's a point that it's important. Yeah. So.
And it's interesting how when you read scripture in your language, how it's different. Like there is a more of a connection there. So somebody could say Jesus in English or say it in another language, but when it's in your language, it is like it is even more comforting than if you heard it somewhere else.
Yeah, that's because it's your language that you kind of grew up with and it's part of your makeup.
Yeah. So which Australian word or phrase did you adopt? And let's see, because there's actually a few that I've now heard from people that they're kind of two groups.
Well, it's definitely not shrimp and Barbie. I think it's just that, I think good on you, mate. I find it a little funny when I say that, but, I think that's a good one, Yeah, it's like you actually saying good, somebody, yeah. Good
encouraging
on,
somebody,
yeah. But it's just that when I struggle to say that because it doesn't come on naturally to me. But I think that's a good that one, yeah.
It's fantastic. Thank you so much for speaking to me. I really enjoyed.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yeah.